katato, katangi te oe, katangi te kaka, katangi hoko hoki a au. No mai, haro mai, kanui te mihi. Welcome to this event, Beyond Blame, Christianity and the Future of Creation. Nothing small in there. So welcome, and this conference has been brought to you by three organisations: New Zealand Christians in Science, which is a very new organisation; the Otago University, not a new organisation; the Centre for Theology and Public Issues; and also Arosha Aotearoa New Zealand, which celebrates its 10th anniversary this year. Let me first start, because this is the most important thing, by welcoming Derek, who's going to talk a little bit about the housekeeping, so you know where to go if you're caught short.
Kia ora koutou and good afternoon. I'm Derek Woodard-Lehman. As he just said, I teach theology and ethics for the University of Otago, but I also look after the Wellington program of our Centre for Theology and Public Issues, and it's in that capacity as a partner in this great initiative for the conference that I'm here this afternoon. And since this is not Otago's place, but it's the place where we have our Wellington offices, I am also the sort of host site coordinator, safety warden, and so on and so forth. So a few announcements by way of health and safety to start. In the event of an earthquake, drop, cover, and hold, standard procedure. When things stop shaking, listen up, and if we need to leave the building, we can do so either out the main entrance that you came through or out the back of this hall and to the right through the stairwell indicated by the green curved arrow. Our assembly points would then be the car park out back and the courtyard out front. Should there be a fire, same idea, exit through whichever door is closest to you and not obstructed by flames. But in the far more likely event that you need the loo, one's located right here behind him at the front of the hall to your left, my right. There are two others upstairs. The first is on the landing of the main stairwell, which is again out the back to the right, and the second is off the main hall on the second floor proper. And if you flip over your little registration schedule, the map of the place is on the back with the all-important location of the restrooms. So that's health and safety. Now for matters electronic and technological. First and foremost, let me invite you to put all devices, whether they be tablets, phones, or computers, or other things I know not of, put them into silent or quiet or whatever mode where they don't, you know, ring out in the middle of someone's karakiki or presentation. So turn them off or turn them down so as not to disrupt the proceedings. Second, for those of you who need Wi-Fi, the network is the St. John's Guest Wireless. That's also printed on the front of your schedule. And the password is listed here, VC87. EIA, that's Victor Charlie 87 Echo India Alpha. It's on your schedules. It's also printed on the signs on each of the doors where the sessions are, should you forget it. But just tap on that wireless network. You'll get a little window that will ask for this password. You put it in, it will say success, and you can go about your business. For those of you who are on social media, we invite you to use the following hashtags for today's conference. The main conference is Beyond Blame, all one word, camel case, with the capital B's. And the conference theme, Future of Creation, all one word, all lowercase. Arosha and NZCIS aren't on Twitter, Instagram, and the like, but you can find and follow them on Facebook. The center is, and if you would like, you can make mention of us with @CTPI_Wellington. So that's for those of you given to your devices, your Twitter and your Instagram and the like. If we're going to bother with doing that, we may as well coordinate our message and get the word out about what we've done here today, what we've learned, and what we've heard. We've also invited our individual presenters to give you their information at their discretion. Some will, some won't, but listen up at the top of the presentations and do as you will. That said, welcome again, and In between, should you have any questions, you can try to find me. I'll be scurrying around making sure everything's working properly. For those of you who are presenters, let me say I will try to run through each of your rooms at the top of each workshop to make sure projectors and things like that are working. Right now, all the LCD projectors are set up for HDMI connections. If you need something other than that, you can let me know and we'll work with our adapters and cables to make sure you get hooked up and things work properly. But again, thank you for coming and welcome.
Thanks, David. I think that's probably the most comprehensive housekeeping announcement I've ever heard, and especially with the interactives. It's the sign of the future. It's the 21st century. Let's quickly start with a psalm. Psalm 104. 24 to 31. What a wildly wonderful world, God. You made it all with wisdom on your side, made earth overflow with your wonderful creations. Look, the deep, wide sea brimming with fish. Past counting, sardines, sharks, and salmon. Ships plow these waters, and Leviathan romps in them. All the creatures look expectantly to you to give them their meals on time. You come and they gather round. You open your hand and they eat from it. If you turned your back, they die in a minute. Take back your spirit and they die. Revert to original mud. But send out your spirit and they spring to life. The whole countryside in bloom and blossom. The glory of God, let it last forever. Amen. And into that context, of course, as we know, every week we hear, if you read the papers, articles of chaos. Just last week, the warning that Australia is likely to hit 50 degrees Celsius temperatures within a few years. And last week, publicity on the weather attribution scientific work, trying to show how much more likely some of these events are because of climate change, that heat waves are 10 times more likely, and even Hurricane Harvey many times more likely under climate change than not. And so that's just in the last week. Important though such data and stories are, as we know, some people find that wearisome, a little bit overwhelming, and also some people find it disputable. But the argument really over how advanced society and the planet's ailments are is maybe something of a red herring. So maybe these people have some kind of point. Because you don't need to be heading towards a heart attack to know that there are principles of good nutrition and good exercise for life. And similarly for the environmental crisis, the real question really isn't about how far it's gone, but do we know how to live well on this planet? Do we know how to live well in ways that serve us and each other? And those are questions that we need to ask independently of any diagnostic assessment of how bad the illness may well have progressed. So in other words, environmental questions are not first and foremost technical questions. They're spiritual questions. They're values questions. They force us to ask very deep questions about what's the right way to live and what are the right values to live by. So then, if this crisis is really a religious and moral crisis as well, it's right to ask, what is the role of Christianity in this crisis? And that's one of the themes for today, because given that a quarter of humanity pretty much claims allegiance to Christianity in some form, then it's going to be an important question to ask. And in 1967, so 50 years ago, Professor Lynn White Jr. published a very provocative essay, The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. And there he assigned a major portion of the blame for our current ecological crisis at the feet of traditional formulations of Christianity. He pointed to dominion, he pointed to anthropocentrism, he called Christianity dualist. To be fair, he did recommend a bit of a theological turn using Christianity through St. Francis. But as Wendell Berry has noted, largely as a result of that essay, the culpability of Christianity, quote from Wendell Berry, in the destruction of the natural world and uselessness of Christianity in any effort to correct that destruction is now established cliches of the conservation movement. So,
that's the environment really that this conference speaks into. What has changed since then? What is our future as well? Because if these questions really are moral and spiritual, there must be a role for the church. The environmental movement deeply, I believe, needs the church. When the environmental movement started, it passed the church by largely, and an opportunity really was missed that would have galvanised the environmental movement, because instead of having church support, as so many of the successful movements of history have done, environmentalists tended to emphasise legal and technical solutions. So in many ways environmentalism wasn't whole because it didn't have such a strong spiritual heart as, say, the civil rights movement did. And so it didn't really encompass blue-collar workers. It tended to concentrate on people who live in Greylin or Te Aro or, if you're lucky, Raglan. But it didn't really embrace minorities. And instead it ended up with a bit of an elitist reputation. So if there's a clear lesson then, it's clear that legislative and legal approaches just aren't going to work. It must have an ethical and religious dimension if we are going to solve environmental problems, and also to gather in all those voices that are needed for this. So here we are, 50 years later. What now? How is that going for you, Lynn White Jr.? What's happening now? This is the questions that we're going to look at today. So I would like to introduce our first speaker, who actually has already been up here. Actually, I just realised I didn't introduce myself. I'm Murray Sheard. I'm the chair of Arosha. I have been for the last 4 years, so Arosha being one of the organisations that organised this conference. So let me introduce Derek. Derek Woodham Lehman is the lecturer with the Centre of Theology and Public Issues at the University of Otago. Based here in Wellington, though, I understand? Yeah. Yeah. All right, easy to find. Yep. Good stuff. And Derek studied theology. He studied philosophy and ethics and politics at Duke University and Princeton Theological Seminary. He's taught at Princeton University and the Lutheran Seminary at Philadelphia. And he's published over a dozen articles and book chapters. So I welcome you, Derek. Thank you.
Good afternoon again, and let me thank Murray for his leadership with Arosha and for the introductions and Master of Ceremony role here, and thanks especially to Nicola Hoggard-Cregan of NZCIS hiding in the back, and also to Iris Lee and Andrew Shepherd of Arosha for their partnership and leadership in planning today. It's been a real pleasure and a privilege to work with you, and it's a great thing to finally see the event come off that we've been working on for several months and to see all you here today. Now, in this first session, I have the task of introducing or perhaps reintroducing you to the little essay, The Historical Roots of the Present Ecological Crisis by Lynn White, that Murray just spoke about briefly. So I will do that, and that will sort of serve as our point of departure for the conversation today. And my goal is to get us all on the same page with the White thesis and to get us up and running in our conversation. With that in mind, let's just get right to it. So 50 years ago, Lynn White announced to the world that the single largest cause of the ecological crisis was nothing other than Christianity. If you want to know why the sky's falling, if you want to know why the seas are rising, look no further than the religion whose God came from heaven to earth in human form and then turned around and went back to heaven, leaving the earth behind. In short, shame on us. We Christians are to blame for this mess. Now, why did he make this claim? That's the question I want to answer. But before I get to those answers, I want to, by show of hands, how many people have actually read that little essay? So in this crowd, probably more than average, maybe a third, leaning towards half, but not nearly everyone. Good. For our purposes, we can answer the question of why he laid this blame at the feet of Christianity, why he puts this shame on Christian religion for the ecological crisis. We can isolate it into what we might just call four basic claims. The first is an empirical claim about how organisms interact with their environment. The second is the theological claim about the character of Christianity. There's a third claim about the historical influence of Christianity on Western civilization, particularly on its economic and technological life. And last but not least, and I say last but not least because this fourth claim is often unwittingly overlooked and sometimes consciously suppressed. And that fourth claim has to do with the positive role of religion in responding to the crisis. A lot of times people stop reading after the critique and don't get to the turn towards solutions. So those are the four claims, and we'll take those in turn. Now, as some of you might know, Lynn White, pictured here on the left-hand side, was a medieval historian, and one of his main emphases was on the development of technology in the medieval period, and particularly agrarian technology. And with that perspective in mind, he approached his thesis. Now, he first made this claim on the day after Christmas in 1966, at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Now, setting aside the question of why the heck these people were meeting the day after Christmas, he published that speech 1 year later in this issue of Science Magazine, March 10th, 1967. And that's where he first trotted out this claim for the world to hear. Now, the substance of that claim begins with that first empirical claim. He tells us that throughout history, human technology has had an impact on its environment. And as an historian of technology, he has in mind things like this: the use of fire to drive prey towards hunters, and the massive use of this technology, or this technique, he says, in the Pleistocene era, first created massive swaths of grassland around the planet and eliminated most of the largest land-living mammals of the time. He also has in mind things like the invention of the moldboard plow. I know that's top on your list of great historical inventions, but for him it's a significant one because that technology of plowing allowed for a shift from small-scale subsistence plots run by families to larger-scale surplus plots geared towards more production like these enclosed fields shown from above in England. And that shift from subsistence to surplus, from farming for oneself to farming for a profit, and the shifts in land use are oftentimes referred to as the death of the commons, because land was enclosed like this and stopped being the more common property of the community. White also has in mind more recent technology, like the Aswan Dam, completed in 1970, and when it flooded some 5,000 square miles. 5,000 square miles, that's a lot, now underwater. And last but not least, he also has in mind the automobile. Not your automobile and my automobile, the ones that we worry about their emissions, but these first horseless carriages that shared the roads with trolleys and horse-drawn carts and wagons. The first impact of the automobile, he tells us, was to eliminate large flocks of urban sparrows who fed on the massive piles of horse dung littering urban streets. So White's point is that throughout human history, our organism and our technology have had impacts on the environment, and they tend not to be good. They tend to be destructive. He then draws a contrast with another organism, the coral. And he says that all species impact their environments, but the coral, for one example, in achieving its species-specific ends, actually winds up creating massive underwater habitats that are homes and food and hunting grounds for other species. So the coral, in reaching its own ends, actually becomes a means to the flourishing of other species. And he compares and contrasts this to human organisms. When we tend to meet our ends, we tend to unhome other organisms, as is depicted here in a photograph of clear-cutting in the Ecuadorian rainforest. So we might say that when humans achieve our ends, that means the end of other species. His theological point is the one that we've heard about already. He says in the sort of soundbite, if there was Twitter back then, this would have been the tweet to go with the article: Christianity is the most anthropocentric, that is, human-centered religion the world has ever seen. Excuse me. Now, he offers as evidence for this claim the two creation sagas in Genesis 1 and 2. In the first, God gives humanity, quote-unquote, dominion over the creation. And in the second, God commissions humanity to cultivate, to ahad, or tend, shamar, the garden. Now he says that the picture of cosmology, that is the picture of the world that results from those biblical passages, is, which we have to admit is well attested in the tradition, looks something like this. How many of you have seen this diagram or some version of it in your travels or studies? Yeah, it's hard to run in circles like these without seeing it at some point. Now we see a triangle. And at the top of the triangle is humanity, and in this version, male humanity. So this is a higher octane version of the diagram, a stronger critique. But White thinks that even this diagram isn't quite right. He thinks a truthful, accurate diagram would look more like that, where humanity is not simply separate from other creations, but other creation and creatures are subordinate to humanity. And again, if Lynn White had Twitter, another one of his famous remarks is this: God planned all of this explicitly for humanity's benefit and rule. No item in physical creation had any purpose save to serve human purposes. So White's theological point is this: theological anthropocentrism, thinking of ourselves as the top or center of creation, leads to instrumentalism in technology and economy. Now, even if the age-old legend is true, that Michelangelo looked at the block of granite and immediately saw the David within it that he would sculpt out, White's point is that when human beings more generally look at something like a tree, we tend to see something stupid and trivial, like a box of toothpicks. This is what he means by instrumentalism. We look at a tree and we see toothpicks. We look at a landscape, and rather than valuing it for itself, we see the possibility of a human habitation, a suburban subdevelopment. And this is what he means by instrumentalism. Now, White's third point, and this is again, practical point, is that thinking and doing are not separate as they are in this somewhat comical newspaper cartoon. He doesn't think that thinking and doing are separate, let alone alternative options. We might say that ideas have legs. They get up and walk out the door and start doing things in the world as humans act and interact around. Now, his point is that by teaching Western civilization to think anthropocentrically, Christianity taught Western civilization to act instrumentally, to look at trees and see toothpicks, to look at landscapes and see subdevelopments, and in point of fact, to look about at just about anything and to start seeing dollar signs. So he thinks that this anthropocentric worldview leads to instrumentalizing behavior, where we take things that have intrinsic value unto themselves and use them merely as means to our own ends, most of which are fairly shabby and trivial. In the words of Joni Mitchell's famous folk song, Big Yellow Taxi, the human organism's effect on the environment is to tear down paradise so we can put up parking lots, if you remember that song, or the Counting Crows cover of it more recently. Now, White doesn't mention it in the famous article that we've kind of convened around today. But the roots of his article about the roots of the ecological crisis actually date back to 1926, 40 years prior to the article, almost a century removed from where we sit now. As a young 19-year-old man, White was traveling around the world and found himself in Ceylon, what we now call Sri Lanka. And he observed road construction. They were building a road from the tea plantations in the interior to the seaside ports. And like this road, of much more recent vintage, that road cut a path through the jungle. And like that road, it carved into the clay soil. But unlike this road, White observed that these local laborers were leaving behind huge mounds of red clay. And when he asked what those mounds were, he was told that they were snake nests. And it occurred to him at the tender age of 19 that the reason that these laborers were going out of their way to leave intact these nests was because they were Buddhist. And they had a religious worldview in which other life forms, other species, other creatures had intrinsic sacred value. So rather than just paving over anything, they went out of their way to leave these mounds intact. So this, in many ways, is sort of the first thought White had about the historical roots of the ecological crisis and the connection between a religious worldview, something one thinks, and actions in the world, particularly actions related to technology and economy. Making a road? Technology. Getting the tea from the plantation to the coast to sell? Economy. Now he tells us this, what people do in their about their ecology depends on what they think about themselves in relation to the world. And he thinks that religion, as illustrated by that example of the road in Sri Lanka, is a particularly powerful motivator of action. And because Christian religion is the mother of Western civilization, he thinks that Christianity is the father of the ecological crisis. Because Christian faith taught Western civilization to think anthropocentrically, Western economies and science and technology in turn acted instrumentally, and that's the root of the shame and the blame that he lays at our feet today. But again, there's this fourth claim that I told you is often, overlooked, if not suppressed. This is what I've called his practical claim. And he tells us that because the roots of this crisis have to do with things we think, with our worldview, and particularly with religious aspects of it, any plausible solution has to incorporate those aspects as well. It can't simply be a technical intervention. If it is, he warns us we'll get something like this. Does anybody happen to know what or even where this is? Or want to take a guess? Looks like Holland, well done. You win the prize. In the back? Yeah, so this is a wind farm in Holland. And this is an illustration, I think, of what White would think of as an inadequate and indeed a contradictory response to the ecological crisis that responds solely from a scientific and technical point of view and leaves unquestioned and unchanged the wider religious and worldview issues that he talked about. So yes, on the one hand, wind power is great. It's renewable, it cuts down on emissions, we get away from coal-fired power plants, nuclear reactors, and the like. But to White, this still leaves intact that anthropocentric worldview as represented by the dike, that's the green embankment coming up from the highway, where in Netherlands for centuries, ever since they invented the first windmills, not these fancy turbines, but the old quaint ones that you see in old photographs, they've been, quote-unquote, reclaiming land from the sea by manipulating the coastline. So for White, this would be something of a contradiction. Yes, wind power is good, it's responding appropriately, but it's responding in this context of an inappropriate relationship to the environment, namely the manipulation of the coastline to reclaim other land. You might think of it like this. Suppose someone was a smoker and was at risk for lung cancer. It wouldn't nearly be enough to switch from hand-rolled, unfiltered cigarettes to low-tar filtered cigarettes or e-cigarettes or vaping. The point is not to switch from one cigarette to another in that example. The point is to what? Kick the habit. So this is an example of, you know, sort of making an intervention but not kicking the habit in the way that White suggests we should. He says, more science and more technology are not going to get us out of the present ecological crisis until we find a new religion or rethink our old one. Now, White is often presented as anti-Christian, if not a new atheist, an old one. But he says explicitly at a couple places in the article he's a churchman, which is a somewhat antiquated term for a churchgoer. And this is often ignored. And he says that if we're going to fix this problem, science and technology are not enough. We need to work on our worldview. It's particularly on our religious motivations. So as we go throughout the day and we respond and see what's happened since then, we need to keep in mind that White's criticism is an in-house debate. It's a family squabble within the household of faith. He's not arguing against religion. He's not asking us for less religion, let alone none at all. He's asking us for better religion. And he's asking as himself, someone committed to Christianity. So these are White's four claims. The empirical claim that organisms affect their environment and that the effect of human organisms on the environment has been disastrous. His theological claim that Christianity has been, and perhaps still is in many places, a very anthropocentric religion. His historical claim that that anthropocentrism has generated economic and technological instrumentalism. And that last claim, that one that I think is so important that we don't overlook, let alone suppress, that he thinks a big part of the solution to the crisis is itself going to be religious. A new religion, or better, a renewed version of Christianity. And rather than rehearse responses in the decades that have passed since then, I think it would be best if we just start to converse about responses we've seen. So our conversation begins now with your questions, and we have a wireless mic that we can share around so everyone can hear.
Phil, can I get you to do your usual role? Can you do this with much applause and thank you?
So questions about the White thesis, which is our point of departure, the starting place for our conversation. I'll let you distribute the mic. You have much, much power, Phil.
A couple of years ago, I took a youth group down to the Whakapapa, to Ruapehu, and we started off by watching a video of different views of Tongariro National Park. Mm-hmm. They gave the Maori view and explained all the mythology and how Maori were relating to the mountain, which had a very strong emphasis of sacredness around the mountain. They wouldn't climb up to the summit, for example, because they regarded that as inappropriate. And then they flipped to the Pākehā view of the mountain and all the activities, and it was all about skiing and mountaineering. Very utilitarian. The word that came to mind was playground. I don't know if they actually used that word, but it was very strong. So a very strong contrast between the Maori view and the Pākehā view of that mountain. And I thought that it was really poignant because it really summed up a lot of, and in sort of microcosm, a lot of the difference between Maori and Pākehā views of the environment. I've been sort of pondering that difference ever since. I guess my question here is, to some extent, I have sympathy with Lynn White's view because we do seem to have quite a utilitarian view of the environment. And if it didn't come from Christian theology, and I'm quite convinced it didn't,
okay,
where did it come from? Why us Westerners, why do we have such a utilitarian view of the environment?
That's a really good question, and obviously a really huge question. So again, this was a speech at a professional convention that was published in 5 pages. So there's a lot that goes into his thesis that isn't explicitly articulated. And so the question about the connection between Christianity and what you called utilitarianism, what I called instrumentalism about nature, about creation, a lot of that is tied up in historical debates over to what extent the industrial modes of production we now take for granted and the capitalistic modes of economy that now run our world are distinctively Christian and indeed decisively Protestant. This is Max Weber's famous thesis about the Protestant work ethic. So that's a whole conference and conversation for another day. But I think the shorter answer to the question, if not Christianity, then where does it come from? I mean, it has to do with our modes of economy and our modes of technology. So, yes, humanity came out of the cave, we found fire, and we tend to be tool makers. So in a certain sense, that's part of our, I suppose, evolutionary advantage. We know how to see things like trees and do not stupid, trivial things like make toothpicks, but we can make hunting implements and farming implements, and that's part of that. So you'd probably have to look to those kinds of things and think about what is it. I mean, I guess a good example here or a good starting place here would be to try to sit and study the difference between Maori approaches here in New Zealand and Pākehā ones. You know, what is it about the two different worldviews? And I can't tell you beyond that what the answer is. If not Christianity, then what? It's an open question. Sure, go ahead, Jen.
I'm Jan Hamill from Ellington. I was just thinking that I think a lot of the reason that Christianity has a bad press with the environment is the way that Christians have historically thought about the afterlife. It's something separate. You go there when you die and God is going to fix it all up. And they don't see themselves as dwelling in this earth for a very long time, and therefore having to act in a way which means that that we live where we are going to live in what we... the way we live is going to have an effect on our environment. Historically, they've seen it as it doesn't matter because God's going to come and fix it up. And so,
Jonathan up front, probably have time for two-ish more if I'm looking at the clock correctly.
Thanks, Derek, for an excellent summary. But just a quick reflection on the previous questions and comments, and that would be if you think about the work of people like Jared Diamond, he wrote called Collapse, which traverses the failures of human civilizations and communities over, well, thousands of years. It's pretty clear that people of very many different faiths and or non-faiths were responsible for an enormous amount of environmental destruction, whether they had a pantheistic, theistic, non-theistic, whatever, religious worldview. And therefore, just from a historical point, surely Ben White is fundamentally wrong to attribute so much blame to Christianity. To the extent that Christianity is to blame, it is, one could argue, purely the product of Christianity having a significant presence during a period of very significant technological change, which enabled even greater destruction than previous civilizations could inflict.
Yeah. So I'm one quick comment in response to the comment. White is probably too chary about other worldviews, religious and otherwise, in terms of them being sort of more friendly, for lack of a less flat-footed word, to the environment. There are surely other examples of other cultures, other religions doing massive degradation within the relative limits of their technological power at the time. It's not that every other religion but Christianity is good good and green, and Christianity is not. So that's I think a good way to put that.
Mine is a quick comment. Just thinking about that picture that you had up of the plowed fields, and I was just thinking, one of the great principles that the church evolves around is charity begins at the home. And I wonder how much that impacts our view, that we actually start to think about me and mine, and therefore getting beyond to think of that wider world view as our view is limited.
Probably have time for one more, and then we'll move to the next plenary. Lots of responsibility, Phil?
No.
Yeah, I guess here in front, then, I think I saw your hand first.
I would argue that a lot of it has to do with scale, because once you reach a certain scale, you get a tremendously differentiated hierarchical society. You get a break between who benefits and who pays. The people at the top of the hierarchy benefit, everyone else pays, and the environment pays. So when you reach that kind of scale, whatever your religious context, things start to happen that are extremely extractive. So you're not living with your own mess, if you like. You're not living with the consequences of your actions. If you, at the top of the pyramid, are able to organize society in a way that benefits you, but you don't suffer the consequences because you can palm them off on someone else or other species, then things happen that wouldn't happen if we were operating at a smaller scale. And I think if you look all the way back to the dawn of agriculture, mm-hmm. that's really where we got on the imperative to continually expand, because you have your farm, you have your 10 children to help you farm, but you can't divide your farm by 10 every single generation, so they must go out and destroy an ecosystem in another area and turn that into a farm. So you take away the ecosystem, you put in a monocrop instead, and you turn that into human biomass as quickly as you can. Storable surpluses allow you to build hierarchy into your society. And so you have this continual expansion, and you move into a very extractive frame of mind, and that's long before Christianity. So I do think there are instrumentalist arguments, as Lynn White made, but I think there's a far larger context that isn't Christian specific. And to comment on the other lady's point of view, I grew up in North America, and when I look at, say, evangelical Protestantism in North America, mm-hmm. well, there's prosperity gospel, for one thing. The richer you are, the more God must have smiled on you, but that means you had to be even more attractive than everybody else. Plus, there's a sense that the faithful will be raptured off on the cloud, and so, in a way, they want the earth to be destroyed because they're not going to be living in it. They're going to be off somewhere else, and it's part of the price that sinners pay to have to live in a ruined environment. So in that sense, there's an element of Christian in that crossover. But I don't think it's specific to Christianity. Muslims have their own version of the rapture where it's just them on a cloud. And the same argument holds whichever monotheistic religion you apply.
Good. I think we are, in fact, successfully up and running with the conversation. So, well done. Thank you again for your time. We'll move into our second plenary now. Where's Andrew? Are you hiding at the back? Do you need projector, or are you just old school? I love it.